Off the Ball, GAA.
I think if everybody's been honest with themselves, we would have went down to Dublin on the hope that we can ignite the thing again. But once we were beaten by Cork, I think we knew deep down that we weren't going to win in All-Ireland.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Dara's with us. Hello, Dara.
And how are things?
All well. And Keith Tracy is with us as well. Keith, good morning.
Morning, everybody. How are we?
Not too bad. If you want to get in touch with the show, text us on WhatsApp, 0879-180-180. Get your comments coming in on YouTube. You can tweet us at Off the Ball. And I did say that potentially I might facilitate some Keith Tracy, Keith Friday questions today. So
why not?
If you're a fan of Keith Friday, get some of the questions in. And we might try to get to them throughout the show. It is a packed show, though, so we'll see what we can do.
It's been a while.
The stranger the better. Love strange questions.
Get weird.
I want to start with the World Cup, though, last night. So Ecuador 2-1 winners against Germany to keep their World Cup dreams afloat, and also to potentially probably sink Scotland's hopes of getting through to the last 32. You're working on the Ivory Coast Curaçao game last night, Keith?
Yeah, initially my thoughts on the Germans are I think Germany will do okay. They're obviously out of the group, but I don't see them as anywhere near serious contenders. I think there's probably four or five countries within Europe alone that are better placed than Germany. Then you've got the South Americans that, you know, for me would be ahead of them, and there's probably even an African country in terms of Morocco that I would have ahead of Germany. So I think they'll go, you know, last 16, quarter finals, possibly even the semis, but I don't see them as serious contenders whatsoever. The fact that he got beat by Ecuador, I know there wasn't a lot of jeopardy in the game for Germany, but the fact that they're getting beat in the group stage, it just sort of compounds that feeling for me that, you know, they're not really the Germany of old, and it's more a historic feeling. When you think of Germany, you think of the old historic dominance that they've had. But I think they're quite a way off that. But the Curaçao and Ivory Coast game was decent. I was actually impressed with Curaçao. They had a right go and played a good bit of football. They went 1-0 down. Nicolas Pepe scored for the Ivory Coast. All Premier League and Arsenal fans will remember Nicolas Pepe, still playing at a really high level with Villarreal. He put the Ivory Coast up 1-0 up about 7 minutes in, and I thought, that'll kill Curaçao. They won't want to know anymore. And they kept going. Dick Advocaat, I'm sure, is really proud of his players, and they got their first ever World Cup point, their first ever World Cup goal, first ever time at a World Cup, and I think they have a population of about 150,000. It's unbelievable stuff. So although Curaçao fell short, I think the country on a whole will be extremely proud. And Ivory Coast through to the last the knockout phase, which is the first time they've ever done that. So history for another African country.
Yeah, the African nations have actually done phenomenally well at this World Cup. Just looking at the as it stands now, some of this can change over the next couple of days, but Algeria, Iran, you've got Ivory Coast, Egypt, Morocco, Ghana, South Africa, all currently going through to the last 32. That's a really good return for Africa at this World Cup. An African team has never won the World Cup. Morocco definitely putting themselves into the sort of the teams that could potentially go and do it.
Yeah. I said this, it was a couple of Sundays ago with JD, that I wouldn't go as far to say I fancy Morocco to go and win it, but if we were the other side of the World Cup and the result is Morocco have won it, I can't say it's a huge shock. I mean, when you look at Diaz, for me, the way he manipulates the ball, he's brilliant to watch. Some of the passing ability he has. Hakimi is the best right back in the world, although on paper, he doesn't play as a right back. He just wanders and goes wherever he wants. He's so difficult to pick up. The intensity that they can play at, I don't see most of the European countries being able to play with a real intense game for over 90 minutes, given the heat and the humidity. I don't think that comes into Morocco's thoughts. I think if they want to, they can go full court press for 90 minutes and get after teams or as much as they can. So, like I say, I give Morocco a real good chance, and everybody I speak to says semi-finals, finals at a minimum, but nobody has them down as eventual winners, which for me is quite strange. So yeah, I would be happy, and I think anybody who has Morocco in the sweepstakes should be fairly happy.
That's me.
Yeah, you have a chance of winning. I have a chance of losing. I think you have a decent chance of losing as well.
Yeah,
you?
I'd be odds on favour now to lose, I would say, with Tunisia. Yeah, they're minus 10 goal difference at the minute after last night.
Both your sides are out.
Yeah, South Korea as well.
Korea are out. And
it started off so well. Mm. Gave me hope, but I've disappointed since. Yeah, Tunisia, it's between myself and yourself, Keith. As yeah, to who's going to finish last? Money.
I have Uzbekistan. I've been really poor. They're minus 7.
They're playing tonight or?
Is it tonight or tomorrow against the Congo?
Yeah.
The Congo have some decent players, so I'm hoping the Congo put them to the sword.
Congo's the only way I'm getting my money back. So.
They haven't been bad. The Morocco are one of the four sides that already know who they're playing in the last 32, so the confirmed last 32, so it doesn't matter what happens, these games are guaranteed. So we've got South Africa against Canada, Netherlands will take on Morocco, which is a really good last 32 game. Brazil will take on Japan, which also, look, on paper, Brazil are probably favourites for that at this stage, given how Japan have performed at this World Cup. And after their defeat last night, USA still guaranteed top spot in their group. They will take on Bosnia and Herzegovina. We'll run through some quick back page stories. So dominating the back pages this morning on the red tops is Duff of Dreams. This is Cape Verde's chance to go through to the last 32. Pico Lopez on the back of that paper. On the Mirror, they've gone for capable.
Mm.
Not bad. Lopez insists Cape Verde result against Saudis and progression out of the group stages is possible, like Ireland in 02. So quite a lot of the papers are drawing a similarity to Damien Duff's goal against the Saudis in 2002. Cape Verde only need a draw to go through if Uruguay lose to Spain, and they will go through as the second place team. If they do finish second in their group, it sets up a game with Argentina. So Pico Lopez could be facing Lionel Messi. On the back of the Daily Mail, we've got Cape to Victory. Do you get that there?
No.
So it's a reference to Escape to Victory.
Okay.
The famous movie from the World War II escape. In the back of the Indo, this is an interesting one in the back of the Indo. We might pick this one apart there. So Munster player learns that he's leaving the club at a club's award night. So this is a story from Rory O'Connor, who is reporting that prop Connor Bartley was in discussions for his contract with Munster, and there was a club awards night, and essentially he found out at the awards night that he was part of the team, or part of the list of players that would be departing.
Yeah.
So he thought he was going there, he was in discussions on a new contract, but he found out that he's leaving the club along with other members who already knew prior to the event they were leaving.
So they had done like a sending off the week prior with the confirmed departures for the season, and he was not one of them. And it's my understanding that the players that were departing were being presented with a gift at the awards night, and Conor Bartley was called to the stage to receive a gift. To which, of course, he would have been quite surprised because he was not aware that he was in this group of players. And again, my understanding that he accepted this award and then left the venue and went home. to which he then got a phone call saying, sorry about that, that was a mistake. And then apparently then, a week later, it was confirmed that he'd be leaving. So very, very messy situation and very poorly handled by Munster. Has to be said, and it's not a great look. And you can imagine, you know, the embarrassment he would have felt on the night as well, which is just not a nice way to send off a player.
Doesn't kind of take away from the shambles that Munster seem to be in. It adds fuel to the fire that maybe this club isn't the best run at the minute.
I don't think it's just another unfortunate thing. I think it's indicative of what's going on at Munster. There's poor organisation going on right now, and like even the way it's been framed is that it wasn't communicated that he was leaving the club at the time. So again, you know, how is that happening? Poor organisation again. Like, how does he end up on that list of players? How is he called up? And there was obviously a gift there for him. but yeah, I know there's one or two other players as well that, you know, were announced maybe last week in that group of departures that were not aware that they were leaving up until the very last minute. And you can obviously assume that rubbed people up the wrong way, and one or two high profile players there as well that, you know, a lot of Munster fans were not happy about to see go. But yeah, as you say, it's just another bit of fuel to the fire of, you know, Munster. Their organisation just seems to be all over the place, on and off the pitch at the minute. You know, you talk about the Mike Prendergast situation and how they handled him, and him leaving now, it looks like he's going to Bath, which is a top club in Europe. And you're thinking, if, you know, one of the best tens in the world, and Finn Russell is begging this guy to come over and coach him, then you surely do everything you can to keep him in the building, because he's a European class coach. And yeah, I think there's loads more that will come out in the next few weeks around, you know, unhappiness in the camp and discontent with how the club is being run at the minute. But yeah, it's a big mess, and this seems like a kind of a small happening, but like, it's no way to treat a player. And whether it was a mistake or not, I'm sure it was miscommunication, but yeah, that, you can't be doing that, because that not only obviously rubs him up the wrong way, leaves a sour taste in his mouth, but, you know, he has friends at the club and players he would have, you know, bonded with and whatever else, and I'm sure that you know, that'll leave them with a sour taste in their mouth too. So yeah, it's a situation you need to get a handle on.
Mistakes can happen, but it also, we're dealing with humans here, and
exactly,
kind of been a nice way for him to leave the club. We will reach out to Munster to find out what happened there, and hopefully they'll get back to us before the end of the show. Another thing in the papers today, Colm Keyes, we'll touch on this with Jim McGuinness. Colm Keyes reporting that, or not Jim McGuinness, Jim Gavin, sorry. Colm Keyes reporting that there's been a 40% jump in three goals this year. So the two-pointers are down a little bit, but goals are up by 40% this year. So I think that's an interesting point to get stuck into. Another thing, it's not really in the back pages. It broke yesterday, just straight after the show, about 5 minutes after we got off air. Joey O'Brien has parted ways with Shelburne after just 1 year. So it's almost a year to the day since Damien Duff departed the club in similar fashion, Keith. What's going on here?
I'm not too sure, Enda. To be honest, a lot of people will say, you know, Shelbourne haven't been great this season. They're fifth in the league, and that's why Joey has gone. I don't really subscribe to that. And the reason being is that Shelbourne have lost, six games. Shelbourne have lost six games this season. The defeat to Bowes was their sixth loss, and I know that was a bad loss, but Shamrock Rovers have lost five games, St. Pat's have lost five, Bowes have lost six, and Derry have lost seven. And none of those managers, to the best of my knowledge, other than Alan Reynolds at Bowes, who just seems to continually be under pressure. He could win 10 games in a row and lose his 11th, and he would be under pressure. But Rovers, Pats, Derry, none of those managers really seem to be under any great pressure to me. And the fact, like, Shelbourne beat Shamrock Rovers 2 weeks ago in Tolka, and they played really well. I know Shamrock Rovers were the better team. I did commentary on the night. Rovers were the better team, but that can be the case. They defended really well. Harry Wood got up the pitch and was excellent. I think the one thing that works against Joey is, I think five out of six defeats have come at Tolka, and St. Pat's, Dundalk, Derry, Drogheda and Bowes have all gone to Tolka Park this season and won. I think that leaves a bad taste in the mouth of the Shelbourne fans. They've only had the one win in their last five. They're seven points off third place. So there's a little bit you can lean into and go, well, the football side of it, I'm not sure it's just down to football, to be honest with you. And the fact that when Damien Duff left, he had a bit of a sideward swipe at the dressing room also. I don't know whether Joey's maybe just got a bit of a pain in his backside with all this, because that's what it looks like to me. And it doesn't look like it's I brought this dressing room as far as I can, or I can't get a tune out of players anymore. I'm not too sure. I'm sure Joey is a very honest bloke, and I'm sure when the time is right, he will come out and tell us. But I find it very hard to believe that this is all just down to footballing reasons.
Yeah, it's hard to know. It started so well for him, and speaking to some Shells fans when he took over initially, people weren't all that disappointed. They were disappointed initially with Damien Duff leaving, but once Joe O'Brien took over and things started to pick up, people weren't all that disappointed. They were almost thinking that maybe Joe O'Brien potentially would bring them further than what Damien Duff would. But it just didn't really then kick on this year. That's probably the biggest disappointment, is that like there are teams now that have overtaken Shells since that. St. Pat's under Stephen Kenny are the closest thing to Shamrock Rovers at the minute. Bowes obviously in third, but you know, their form hasn't been fantastic this year. There's been some murmurings around discontent at Bowes throughout the year, even though they are third place in the table. Like, there is just the reality here that this, the League of Ireland's really tight, and it doesn't take too long for clubs to rise through the ranks anymore. Look at what Dundalk have done this year.
Yeah.
Once you have a good manager in place, you can rise through the League of Ireland pretty quickly. Obviously, you have to get over that final step and so on of Shamrock Rovers.
Mm.
But the pack between second and sixth, like that, it's as tight as any league.
Yeah. It's extremely tight. It's I hate saying this, but I feel like there's two different leagues. I think Shamrock Rovers, for me, I know St. Pat's fans will be screaming saying we've two games in hand and we could be level on points. I don't see anybody going north of Shamrock Rovers, so I think we're already in a race for the best of the rest. And that can sound a little bit disrespectful, but if St. Pat's, for instance, who are second at the minute, if they do finish second this season, that's progress for them. They've no European football this season, so to finish second for St. Pat's would be progression. Bowes, on the other hand, I look at Bowes at the front end of the park. They've some brilliant, brilliant players. I love watching little Harry Vaughan all of a sudden. Tierney Devoy is a wonderful player. Douglas James Taylor, when he starts up front, is a handful. But defensively, they just look a little bit disjointed at times. And I'm not sure why, because at the start of the season, they look defensively really solid. But it's that word that just keeps coming back in, is consistency. And nobody really seems to have the consistency. And when I look at the league now, I look and think, right, Pats need to go on a bit of an unbeaten run. We need Bowes to go on a bit of an unbeaten run to go and get in and among Shamrock Rovers. But St. Pat's' next five games is Bowes tonight. Then they've got Galway, Waterford, Dundalk and Derry. So by the end of July, we will know an awful lot more about St. Pat's and what type of title credentials they have. And Bowes' next five games, obviously Pats again tonight, then they've got Drogheda. They've a double header against St. Joseph's from Gibraltar in the Conference League qualification, and then they've Galway. That's a tough run of fixtures for Bowes as well, and I just find it very difficult to say I think Pats will win three of those and draw the other two. I think Bowes will win four and draw one. You can see them losing two or three or drawing three or four. I find it very, very difficult to get behind anybody in terms of consistency. But look, I think the next man in, I think that Shelbourne job is still a very, very attractive job. I think Harry Wood, I mean, it was only last week Joey O'Brien was saying Harry Wood is the best player in the league.
Mm.
And I don't think he's far wrong. I still have Bourke and Bourne as the best two creative forces in the league for me. But Harry Wood is right in that conversation. Probably a little trio now. 9 goals and 5 assists. I know they've had, for want of a better phrase, Damien Duff can be a little bit heavy handed. Joey O'Brien seems like he takes absolutely no messing. I think they need somebody just to go in there and motivate those lads. You know, I wouldn't say let them off the lead, but bring a little bit of fun into the dressing room with, you know, a disciplinarian, somebody who's just going to not take no for an answer, really high standards. And look, I think Roddy Collins is somebody who, it would be brilliant for me as a pundit to be watching Roddy known, you know, the amount of times that Shelbourne under Damien Duff had a nil-all draw or a bit of a boring game and Duff would do an interview and you go, there we go, that's what we'll talk about for the next 30 minutes. I think Roddy is like that, and if he comes in, I think it would be really good for the league. He's gold dust in front of the camera, and let's not forget, he's been around the league, he knows what he's doing, he's managed across the water as well. I think he managed in Malta, so Roddy's CV is really good. And it's something I'd love to see.
Interesting chat. We were kind of discussing where Joey O'Brien would go next in the office yesterday, and I kind of threw out maybe he'll end up at Brentford along with Damien Duff and Keith Andrews. But the favourite for the Shelbourne job, or somebody who's been linked today, is actually somebody coming back from Brentford, and that would be Stephen Rice, who is currently set piece coach with Keith Andrews. He did his coaching badges alongside Keith Andrews. He was Ireland under 21's assistant coach, and he's now been working with the Brentford team on set pieces. That'd be an interesting shout. Would that be a step down for Stephen Rice, considering the last Brentford set piece coach got the full time job in the Premier League? Or even for Stephen Rice, is that something that he hasn't managed at senior level yet? So he'd be expected to hit the ground running fairly quickly with a club that has won the league in the last couple of years.
Yeah, he would definitely be expected to hit the ground running. Is it a step down? I'm not so sure. Because of the roles, obviously, if he goes into Shelbourne, he'd be going in as the Shelbourne manager, not as the set piece coach. So obviously that's a bit of an upgrade. The level of football, you would have to concede that it's a downgrade, and I don't mean that disrespectfully, but you know, you can't really compare Premier League football to League of Ireland football. But I'm not so sure, and I don't think you can pluck these managers. I know Stephen Rice has been around the League of Ireland, but he's been over at Brentford now. I would want to sit down with him. If I was part of the Shelbourne hierarchy, I would need to sit down. I would need to know how in tune he is with the league. Does he know the better players? Does he know what formations opposition play? Has he got his finger on the pulse of Shelbourne? Is he aware of Harry Wood? Is he aware of the problems that maybe Joey O'Brien has had? It's a difficult one. If he's not really aware, and you know, Stephen Rice obviously has his hands full with Brentford, so it would be more than understandable if he didn't quite have his finger on the pulse. But like I said, I just think a safe pair of hands is somebody who knows the league, who's been around. And I think when you look at Martin O'Neill and Roy Hodgson, these older managers are coming back, and it's not like football for me is like fashion. We went down the Pep Guardiola route. Everybody's trying to play the same brand of football. I think it's starting to come back around now, where it's less tactics heavy, less formation orientated, and just about motivating players. At that level of football, and players know what they're doing generally. You know, you might want to tweak something here or there, but if you motivate lads, it's an attribute that I think is really undervalued in modern day football. Just motivating lads to run around and outwork opposition. 9 times out of 10, if you outwork the opposition, you will win the game of football. And you know, it's as black and white as that, really.
Anyone in the league that you think could do the job?
Well, I've heard Kevin Doherty been thrown around, and look, if Kevin was to end up getting the Shelbourne job, you couldn't begrudge him. The job he's done at Drogheda over the last couple of years has been outstanding. I'm not sure whether he would fancy it at the minute, to be honest, because I look at Drogheda and think they still have a little bit to go. We still think they're capable of a little bit more. But how ambitious is Kevin? Because if he wants to manage in Europe, he has a chance to do that with Shelbourne. They won the league last season. So I think it is probably a better move, but yeah, it's down to Kevin whether or not he fancies it. But if he does want to, if he wants to manage at a higher level, he will have to jump sooner or later.
Previously managed Shelbourne, I think, back in the day, but obviously it's a different club now.
Yeah.
And he's a different manager now. He's had success. I think he'd be a fantastic appointment. And maybe the ceiling is higher with Shelbourne than it would be with Drogheda. I mean, Drogheda have been a very well-run club over the last number of years, but you're thinking, are they ever going to challenge for a league? Probably not. European football would be a massive success for them. And Shelbourne are a club that if you get it right, you're in the running for a league title.
Well, that's the word is expectation. There's expectation at Shelbourne because of, you know, they were the champions not so long ago. At Drogheda, I think Kevin turns up at the start of every season and you think if we stay in the league, that'll be a success. And again, I don't mean to be disrespectful. I think that's the reality from a Drogheda point of view. Although Kevin, over the last couple of years, and those Drogheda players have put a lot of those fears to ease. But when I played at Drogheda, Dundalk were an extremely, extremely good team and they were the better of the Louth derby. I think that's starting to swing back in Dundalk's favour again. And you look at the league table, you look at the players that Dundalk have, I think Dundalk are going to start dominating over Drogheda again. I think Kevin is probably intelligent enough to look down the road and think, yeah, if we're going to be the lesser of the two Louth clubs, why not jump across to Shelbourne? But like I say, these are all rumours I heard and there's absolutely nothing behind it, just all rumour.
So more stories in the paper. This is an interesting one. I think we actually mentioned it, but it wasn't in the physical paper yesterday. Joe Canning in the Times saying that hurling needs a bunker style system like in rugby to help head off serious injuries. So he's obviously talking about the heavy hits that go on in hurling, and he goes in to discuss like tackles that people on TV with his career previously brought up as, God, that's what hurling is all about. That's how hurling should be played. But in reality, he left some of those games concussed and with head injuries and had headaches for a couple of days afterwards. And it's just, he's speaking with candor that you don't usually get from ex-pros about this. Dara, like, do you think there's a good idea, hurling, getting a rugby-style bunker system? I know you're not a huge fan of the bunker system as it currently stands in rugby, but maybe something with the head high tackle might be something we need in hurling.
My biggest issue with the bunker is the over-reliance, and you see it in football with VAR, that referees stop making decisions. And maybe it's a case-by-case basis that that's actually what's needed in hurling. A bit more of the onus is taken away from the ref because there's so much going on around the pitch that it's impossible to keep an eye on everything. But with rugby, I found, especially when I was brought in, it's calmed down a little bit now, but you just find that every single decision that was in the realm of a red card or a yellow card was being sent to the bunker. And it was kind of like, what's the point in the ref then if everything's just going to be decided by this bunker? I don't know if that's the solution. It's not. I don't think it's a terrible shout. I would nearly look at just something like, you know, the way in gum shields in rugby now, they have sensors that if a player is hit and, you know, maybe the physios on the sideline don't pick it up and aren't able to pull the player off the pitch, the physio team will get a notification that a player has been hit at a certain speed or a certain velocity and they'll come off the pitch for a HIA. Something like that, maybe put in a helmet where collisions like that and the force is felt through the helmet or whatever sensor is in it, then a player has to come off and be assessed. With collisions like that, they're obviously obvious that, you know, a player must come off after that. So I don't know how you tackle that. It should just be a blanket red card for me in that scenario, like running into a tackle like that. Like, obviously the David Reedy one is the most recent one.
See, I think the issue is, and what Joe Canning is saying in the piece, is that not all hits are equal. So the David Reedy one is one where you look at, the referee did deal with it, it was a straight red card.
Yeah.
But what he's talking about here is that sometimes there's tackles where somebody will line you up and hit you a smack, and it won't necessarily be a dirty tackle or one that's an obvious one, like in the David Reedy case. It'll be something like,
you get the timing wrong.
You just miss the tackle, or the player dips his head 4 inches and then suddenly you connect with his head. I think that's what he's talking about here. So maybe it's more of the accidental stuff that he's saying this needs to be looked at a little bit.
Maybe. Yeah, like it's, you get into black and white territory there in terms of, like, with rugby, it's a very similar thing in that a big thing that's been happening over the last while is, you know, the onus on a tackler to drop their height when they're going into a tackle. So maybe a player is absorbing a tackle, but they're at head height with the attacker and they clash heads and that's sent to the bunker or whatever, and they get a yellow card or potentially a red card. It's difficult to assess what someone's intentions are running into a tackle at the same time. So the easiest thing and best solution is that you just stamp out those type of challenges. And I know people won't be happy with that, and the hurling, you know, traditional watchers and players won't be on board with that. But, you know, I don't think the intentions with the David Reedy tackle were bad. I don't think he was trying to obviously hurt him or anything like that, but that is the result of those type of challenges. So generally in any other sport, you would stamp that out. You're like, okay, well, that's just dangerous. We can't facilitate those type of challenges anymore. At the same time, the bunker would maybe, you know, reduce the amount of games that are affected, like the overall game. You don't want to see players getting sent off in the first 5-10 minutes of a game because of a challenge that wasn't intended to be a red card level tackle. But I don't know what the solution is. The easy one, as I say, is probably just to stamp it out and give a red card, blanket red card. But I get what Cannon is saying at the same time, but I don't know, you're getting into dangerous territory then and over refereeing, and then I don't know if GA has the officials as well to run a bunker like that. They don't have the personnel.
It'd be impossible to have it in the club level as well, so again, you're falling into that element of, does the intercounty league or championship need different rules than club? And that complicates the whole scenario. So, I mean, it's a tough one. Maybe the hurling review committee will be looking at that and looking at head high tackles when they're looking into the rules. Also in the papers this morning is Kerry stick with tried and tested for Tyrone test in the back of the Daily Mail. Con named for Dubs. So the team news is out for the All-Ireland quarterfinals this weekend. Cork taking on Mayo at 4 p.m. on Saturday. Kerry face Tyrone at 6:15. On Sunday we have Louth against Monaghan at 1:45 and Galway against Dublin at 4 o'clock on Sunday. The team news is out. Dublin have made one change. Owen Kennedy starts at fullback. He comes in for Nathan Doran, and Conor Callan starts, which is big news considering he was sort of limping. We weren't sure if it was a hamstring issue or if it was cramp or what was going on. No changes for Kerry for their game against Tyrone. Micheál Burns is back on the bench though after his two-game suspension for that clash with Ryan McHugh. Then Monaghan, big news for Monaghan is that Rory Beggan starts. So that's big news. That's huge for Monaghan. If he's fully fit, he might not be fully fit. He might just be, we'll throw him in. This is our chance to get an All-Ireland final.
If he's at all ready to play a game, you have to start him. You have to at this point.
Absolutely. We'll be talking to Darren Hughes about that game at 9:15. Keith, tonight we have Cape Verde against Saudi Arabia in the World Cup. This is Cape Verde's chance of going through to the last 32, and Pico Lopez's chance to maybe set up a date with destiny and Lionel Messi.
Yeah, it's brilliant, isn't it? And again, the amount of people that were giving out to me about, you know, it's a bloated World Cup and this, that or the other. Curaçao last night were still alive in the group. If they'd have won the game against Ivory Coast, they would have went through. Cape Verde, coming into their last group game tonight, are still alive, which is absolutely brilliant. And I love latching on to an underdog story, especially in the early stages of the World Cup. And Cape Verde have been absolutely that. I mean, Vecinha, in the 40-year-old in goal, his interview after speaking about his mother not being able to come over because of the visa required and not having enough money, that sort of stuff just endeared him to me, and I thought, I want you to do well. I want you to do so much more than you're capable of. And Lopez, I mean, like, even my son now is stopping me talking about Pico Lopez, and, you know, I'm trying my best to get him into the League of Ireland football. He's Manchester City mad at the minute, but he's stopping me talking about Pico, and I'm saying he plays in League of Ireland, Daddy, and I'm sure I'll end up getting to bring him to a Shamrock Rovers game when Pico returns. But it just feels like it's been, Ireland has had a small lift because of what Pico has done with Cape Verde. I can only imagine what Cape Verde is like at the minute. They've been absolutely outstanding, and they should be extremely proud of themselves. Every single one of them have played above themselves and give a really, really good account of themselves. And by the way, like, they were excellent against Spain to get the draw. They're ranked, Cape Verde are ranked 67 by FIFA. Saudi Arabia are ranked 64th. This is a tight game, you know, on paper it should be close. So I think Cape Verde have an excellent chance, and as you say, and a draw will be enough to get them through. So it's excellent, and I'll be tuning in. Is it 1 o'clock in the morning they kick off at? And I'll be hoping and praying that Pico sticks around at the World Cup for a little bit longer.
Mm. Yeah, so we have a couple of big games tonight. We've got Cape Verde against Saudi Arabia at 1 o'clock. Simultaneous to that, we have Uruguay against Spain. So Cape Verde's chances are sort of hinging on Spain demolishing Uruguay, which could well happen based on what we've seen from them over the course of the tournament. Middle of the night, we've got New Zealand against Belgium, Egypt against Iran. Then tomorrow night at 10 p.m, England take on Panama, Croatia against Ghana. We might save our powder on England for the football section on the show. We've got a question here, though, for yourself, Keith. It comes from John. Which World Cup team would you like to play for? Would it be someone like Cape Verde, who's an underdog and you have anything you do is good if you get any sort of result? Or would you like to be part of the big dogs? Or is there a team that you think you'd like to play for?
Yeah, it's a great question, that, because you're coming at it from two different angles. Like, a Cape Verde view, as you say, any sort of positive output is, you know, met with almost hysteria. Whereas if you're in the French dressing room, you've almost got to win it, or the English dressing room, you've got to win it for it to be deemed a success. But I don't think there's a better feeling than getting off the plane and arriving at your hotel and thinking, we could win this. There's no better feeling. And for the feeling that Cape Verde have had, all the positives that have come for this for them, you know, they're there, but they're not really in with a chance of winning. They're never ever going to win the World Cup. But yeah, I think that feeling of stepping out onto the pitch with, we could win this. So I think I'd love to be part of France. I think they're the best team. They've had the best start. The opening group game against Senegal, I thought was impressive. So yeah, I would like to play for France. I wouldn't be totally upset if I was playing for the Spanish either, to be honest. The way they keep the ball is outstanding. So yeah, and even Argentina, you know, just to be there and be one of those players that every time they get it, just look for Messi. Where does he give him the ball? Oh yeah, I would insert myself into that French team if I had an option.
Who are you putting out? Olise, Dembele or Mbappe?
Let's be honest, absolutely none of them are getting out of that team for me. But I would love to play alongside Olise. I would love to play alongside Dembele. To be honest, look, I have a very high opinion of myself, but it's not big enough to drop any of them lads. I think I'd be happy to be getting splinters on my bum on the bench in that French team.
Have you ever seen anything like the dynamic with Argentina? That every player is serving one man, player on the team.
It's so strange. I was thinking Messi's second goal the other day when I think it was DePaul. There was like a little bit of a scramble in the 18-yard box and the ball comes out to DePaul and you're thinking, hit it. Yeah. And he takes a touch and you can see him going, where's Messi? And he gives it to Messi and then Messi has three players in front of him. And one way or another, like he always does, he manages to get it into the back of the net. But I was thinking, the right decision was for DePaul to hit that, but he didn't. He just thought, it's not my, it's all about Messi. And I seen a lovely little one now, and I know social media is not really my thing, but I got sent a video of Messi in the dugout after the game. And I think it was Molina comes up to him and says, like, you sit down. And Messi, like, no, you sit down. And he sat just like on his arse on the grass. And yeah, he doesn't. Although he is the main man and he's the one that Argentina are looking for and always give him the ball, he seems to still have that humility with everybody else, which I think endears him to people an awful lot more than somebody else possibly in a Portuguese jersey.
So Rodrigo de Paul, he is actually known as Messi's bodyguard.
Yeah.
So he went over to Inter Miami and essentially anybody touches Messi, you're dead. You're getting attacked from Rodrigo de Paul. But he was also himself and Messi, I don't know if you noticed, it was pointed out that Messi has, like, he's in incredible shape for this World Cup. Himself and Rodrigo de Paul were doing some, it's been labelled the double shift, where they've been doing an individual training plan together outside of Inter Miami. They took over the Argentina physio has come over to help them as well. So basically outside of Inter Miami this year, the two of them have been going through rigorous training sessions to get in shape for this World Cup.
Aye.
Which is an interesting one, because I guess the question with Messi going into this World Cup was, he's playing MLS football, is he going to be physical enough? Is he going to still have that sharpness? And he definitely seems to still have that, like, one burst of sprint.
Yeah, yeah.
In short, tight areas, which is kind of like, that's the Messi program, isn't it?
Yeah, he's still capable of making anybody look extremely silly. He's still got that tight control. It's like he's got Velcro on his boots and the ball is just stuck there. Yeah, he still has a little bit. And like you ended the opening game, I looked at him and thought, what's he got left? Hat-trick on the opening game. And I know you could say Zidane in the goal could have done it a little bit better for two of them. But his performance in general, his movement, the way he swivels those hips and just, you know, leaves people for dead, he still has it. And that's, at his age, it's still very, very impressive. I give Argentina a chance. I've been impressed with them. I do worry about their defence. I know people will say Cristiano Ronaldo and Otamendi have already won the World Cup with Argentina, but it's hard. But again, I think one of the things that I like about this World Cup is you can pick holes in all the big hitters. I mean, you look at the English, their defence, look at Argentina's defence, the Spanish centre forward, the French possibly defensively as well. There's holes everywhere. Brazil in the middle, legs with Casemiro and Bruno Guimaraes, the left back and right back. There's weaknesses in all the big boys, which, I think is good for the World Cup, because it's hard to pick a winner. But I did find it funny. I've never seen Messi with his top off. Very rarely have I seen him with his top off. But in the World Cup, I've seen it a handful of times. And I think even Messi knows I'm in decent nick here. But his interview he did after the game, He was asked, you know, a run-of-the-mill question, but his answer was, I can't really think right now. I'm really tired. I'm really tired. I'm having trouble talking properly. And I thought, that didn't sound like Messi. I've never seen him as mentally drained after a game. And does he have the robustness? Because you can't see Argentina taking him off. You know, even if it's 60 minutes and they're 2-0 up, you'd imagine the fans, the World Cup as a whole, do not want to see Messi on the bench at all. So I hope his fitness is not an issue, when I know he was injured in the build-up leading into this. But yeah, I've been really impressed by him.
He also, like, I know he scored, what, 5 goals already, and he has been fantastic. He did give the ball away a couple of times. He hasn't been flawless. Like, we're not watching Messi from 2013 here.
When he gives the ball away, he's the only player in the world, when he gives it away, you think, will he even bother saying that? Well, even by a highlight, he just lost the ball.
I think that's poor for Messi there.
Yeah.
He fires one into the top corner, then 2 seconds later.
He missed the penalty. When he missed the penalty.
Like, it was a shocking penalty as well.
It was. And like, I hate that run-up, that little stuttery run-up. I think you're giving the goalkeeper a bigger percentage to save the ball. But when he missed, you're looking at him and thinking, how are you going to react to this? And just nonchalantly arrives at the edge of the box, passes it into the back of the net as usual.
It's amazing. Like, I was thinking recently, like, you think about players with similar longevity, like your Ronaldos or whoever else, they've had to kind of move around the pitch and change how they played and adapted their play style to their bodies. He hasn't really had to do that. Mm-hmm. I know he was more of an out-and-out winger when he came through, but very quickly he kind of just turned into a playmaker, and he's just stayed like that all the way through. I know he takes on less work around the pitch, and, you know, he spends 90% of the game walking around the place and doesn't track back or anything like that, but in terms of with the ball, he's never had to adapt his play style at all. Like, no one's figured him out. And like, he's obviously, I think he's the greatest footballer of all time, but even that in itself is extraordinary. Mm. No one has ever really figured out how to play against him. Because he's just, you know, he's, what is he, 38 now?
38
now, hat-tricks at the World Cup. Yeah, he's incredible. And this is the last World Cup we'll see him, so it's an absolute privilege.
Do you know what I really want to see? And not because I think it would have any great outcome on the game. I'd love to see somebody man mark him. Just because seeing him twisting and turning and making a show of somebody, and then you would imagine it'd be a holding midfielder that would be standing on him. Just seeing them getting more and more nervous every time Messi picks up the ball. And, you know, once you get skinned, once you're thinking, oh, I don't want to get really in. I love watching the give and take of when Messi frightens the life out of somebody. But he's that good that I think people go, there's no point man marking him.
Yeah.
There's no point.
It's David Clifford. Mm. It's just no point.
Well, it's also what people have tried.
Yeah.
Yeah.
People have tried, and David Clifford has still scored 872 this year.
Can you imagine, though, being in a dressing room and the gaffer saying to you, I have one job for you today. I want you to mark Messi. Oh, Jesus.
Yeah, well, we were talking about this in the context of David Clifford. It's like, it's one of those jobs, though, that you still, no matter what happens, you kind of come away and nobody can slag you.
Yeah.
After what he does. Like, if your job is to man mark Messi and Messi scores a hat-trick, there's still an argument that you did the best you could.
Yeah. Was it Jisung Park that Alex Ferguson said he should have man-marked Messi in the World Cup, Champions League final? Yeah. That'd have been interesting to watch.
That was it. It's, I mean, we're going on a slight tangent here, but it's amazing when you look back at that period of football, and what Alex Ferguson was saying about that Barcelona side is that he didn't even think to play three in the midfield up until that point.
Yeah.
And then Pep Guardiola just kind of took over, and the three in midfield just became the blueprint for the next 5-6 years, and then obviously move into more defensive football in the mid-2014s and beyond. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens with football over the next couple of years. In the papers as well, we might touch on this in a little sec in more detail, but it seems like Mikel Arteta is going to double down next year. Based on the transfer rumours, it looks like potentially Bruno Guimaraes might be signing for Arsenal. So that would be a signing that he's going to look for an enforcer a little bit more in the midfield. I know Guimaraes is a good attacking player as well, but his job is laying down markers on players most of the time.
Yeah, I heard this. I'm not so sure that's... Like, Bruno Guimaraes is a good player. I really like him. I think he would slot into Arsenal really well, but I think Arsenal have, I wouldn't call them problems, but I think they have positions they should be going after with it, you know, a little bit more urgency. Left wing would be one. Martinelli is not bad, but you know, can you trust him over 38 games to get the numbers and the goals and the stats required? Trossard, I think there's little rumours of him possibly moving on, wanting more game time. So I think left wing for me, and you know, Bruno Guimaraes to get out of Newcastle, you'd be costing a hefty chunk of money, and I think that would take away from the funds available for the left winger. So I would rather see the chunk of money going on a left winger that's going to start. Because like, I think, I know Declan Rice needs a little bit of help in there. England are already saying he could be struggling in the World Cup. But I think we have enough nice neat players in the midfield that can put their foot in and make a couple of tackles. So if we were to get them, by no means would I be annoyed about that. But I think left wing is more of a pressing issue than centre midfield at the minute.
Yeah, just before we go, it's something, this is a bit more downbeat or whatever, but something I meant to mention over the last week or so. I don't know if people saw the cyclist Shane O'Brien, a young fella, 16-year-old, who passed away in Waterford just over a week ago. He's I just wanted to mention him because we were stack show last week and all that, but he's the brother of Liam O'Brien, who's he's currently cycling with Little Trek and is doing very well in Europe. And Shane was much like his brother in that he was coming up through the ranks and had represented Ireland and was firmly on his way to professional racing, and he tragically lost his life there while out training on his time trial bike. I just wanted to mention it today because he would have been competing in the national championships yesterday in the time trial in out west. So yeah, just wanted to mention it's just one of those things where it was a very sad bit of news to come true, and it's you know, it's just a fella who's practicing the sport he loves and trying to get better, and he doesn't get the chance to come home. So it's one of those things that's worth mentioning. Liam, I've spoken to Liam, his older brother, a couple of times over the years at various points, and he's a lovely fella. I know he's taking the news obviously very hard, and he was out competing in the Giro, kind of the youth Giro, it's the Giro Next Gen, and he was doing very well, and he obviously cut that short and came home when he heard the news. And yeah, I just wanted to mentioned the O'Brien family and our thoughts and are obviously with them, and anyone that knew Shane at this very difficult time. Just want to mention it before the rest of the championships this weekend.
Yeah, awfully sad news coming through during the week.